This tape is produced and distributed by the Christian Biblical Church of God, Post Office Box 1442, Hollister, California, 95024-1442. From the Canadian office and offices overseas, listen at the end of the tape. Well, all we see on the news is about going after the terrorist, trying to find OBL, which is Osama bin Laden, and they don't know if they have him, they don't know if he's alive, whether he's escaped, or whether he's dead in a cave. But I saw on CNN the other night that they have a brand new explosive bomb, which is laser-guided, which was designed specifically to go into caves and to blow them up. So they can spot the caves, direct it right down into the tunnel of the cave, and it will go down into the tunnel of the cave, and then it will, before it explodes, it spews out all kinds of flammable liquid, whatever it is. And so here's all the mist of this, whatever it is, kerosene, gasoline, or whatever. And then it explodes, and bam, it sucks all the air out of the cave, and it has such a force of blowing that it will virtually kill anyone who is in there, and then it'll blow out the front of the cave, so then it's shut down. And, of course, they had to have this war in order to test it. And they just got them. They just arrived just this last week, and it showed right on the television how it works. And it's amazing. But how does all of this fit in, and what is happening right now with the things that we see in the Bible, and how does this fit into the end times? And let's ask a question. Does this give us a clue as to how much time we have left? Because I'm sure every time that something happens like this, people say, oh, we're close to the end. The tribulation is ready to begin. And so let's take a look at some things. Let's go back and let's look at the background concerning this. And let's understand from a biblical point of view where we are, and maybe this will also help us understand that maybe there is, as I mentioned in my letter, we are closer to the end than we have ever been, but it's further away than we think. Now, let me just give you another example before we get into the thing concerning Esau, Edom, and Ishmael. Now, I know I covered part of that several weeks ago, but I want to go back over some of it again. But let's come here to Matthew 24, and I'm going to bring this out, and I did bring it out in the letter, but right now my mind is getting focused on doing the introduction for the New Testament and so forth, so that's why I want to bring this out. Now, here in Matthew 24, we have something I think that is very important, which also shows us that the canonization of the New Testament, that Matthew, this is the original writing of Matthew, but an editing insertion by John when they finalized the editing of the New Testament. And also, we have evidence that we had John and Matthew and some of the other apostles all gathered at Ephesus when the final canonization took place just before the book of Revelation. And then the book of Revelation was added. And remember, John was captured. He was sentenced to death. He was put into a pot of boiling oil. And nothing hurt him. He came out of the pot of boiling oil because, you see, the New Testament had to be canonized, and he was the one who Jesus loved the most. And by the way, John and Jesus were first cousins. because Salome was the mother of James and John, who was the sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus. So that's why he lived the longest, and that's why he was the one who finished the canonization of the New Testament. But in Matthew 24, we find this. Let's come here to verse 34. We've covered it before, but maybe not from this point of view. And what this does, this tells us that there were certain fulfillments at that time, but it was not completely fulfilled as it was given here in the book of Matthew. And the book of Matthew was the first gospel to be written, which we have evidence that it was in circulation within 5 years after the crucifixion of Christ. Okay. Now, verse 34 says, let's go to verse 33. Likewise, when you shall see all these things, and that is a key statement, all these things, as we have covered before, when you see part of them, it hasn't been fulfilled. But you must see all of them. Okay? Know that it is near, that is the end, even at the doors. Now, how long between near and at the door, before the door opens and everything takes place, it doesn't tell us. But notice, verse 34, verily I say to you, this generation. Now, remember the sermon I gave several years ago about the two generations. The generation that was then, and then the generation at the end. Because many of these things applied during the time leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem, but not all of these things took place, and the most important thing, which was the signal that these things would take place, did not happen. Now, I'll show that to you here in just a minute. This generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Then he makes this statement. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. Meaning that if you don't see all these things that take place, then know for sure the end is not here yet. So if you see 50% of these things, 60% of these things, 70% of these things, maybe even 80% of these things take place, the end is not here yet. Because we know through prophecy in the cycle of history that these things have a way of repeating. Okay. Now let's come over here, Matthew 24. And let's pick it up here in verse 11. And many false prophets shall arise and shall deceive many, and of course the world is filled with them now. Because iniquity or lawlessness shall abound, and that is the key to the end time. That is the key. Lawlessness and occultism and witchcraft, which is coming upon this end time generation in a way that it has not come in other generations, is absolutely overwhelming. And the beginning of this started with Star Wars, to program everybody's mind into accepting Satanism and witchcraft and good things. You know, remember what it was with Star Wars, let the Force be with you? Well, that force is Satan the devil. Okay. Now we have Harry Potter, and Harry Potter movie is already pushed aside by Lord of the Rings. And you watch the advertisements on TV for the various movies, and you will see how much into witchcraft and occultism it is. You watch some of the children's programs and how much into witchcraft it is. Now, just the other day, I was watching one, just for a few minutes. And one of these comics, so it's all, digitized on a computer. And here this little kid was talking about dying and going to heaven. Now, this is for little kids to watch. And he said, I thought it was going to be wonderful in heaven, but it's not. And I thought, man, are they programming kids for occultism? Because that kind of thing is an out-of-body experience, see. So this generation that we have, the last generation, is going to cause iniquity or lawlessness to abound. And when you think about occultism and witchcraft, they start right out by breaking the first commandment and every single one of the commandments right on down to the end. All of the Ten Commandments, see. So it's going to abound. And the love of many shall wax cold. And of course, technology even makes it grow even colder, because you don't interface with people anymore on a personal basis. You just do it on a machine. And it's kind of like, speaking of machines, it's kind of like when they interviewed the pilots. Well, what is it like to be flying up there and you drop all of these guided bombs and laser bombs? And one of the pilots said, well, it's just like a computer game. You blow up a truck, you don't think of people in it. It's the truck. It's the target that's blowing up. And you're so far removed that you have no feeling or empathy toward anything that's happening with human beings down there on the earth who are in the tank or in the truck or whatever it may be. And so they're even in wartime. And you know, he had no feeling one way or the other. Just a job, just a target. You have the equipment and the technology to blow them up and win the war. Now, we also have the same thing in the society. The love of many shall grow cold. Killings, murders, and all that sort of thing. Now, here's where we are, verse 13. But he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. So this is telling us, we have more time than we have figured, even though we're closer to the end than we have ever been. Now, verse 14, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world. What is all the world? Mark 13 says, published in all the world. And the gospel is the Bible. So we have a combination of the Word of God being published and the Word of God being preached, then, which has to do with the churches of God and their various different organizations. And by the way, if you would count the number of people keeping the Sabbath today, there are literally millions of people keeping the Sabbath around the world in various churches of God and Church of God Seventh-day and Seventh-day Adventist. You know, I think they're part of the Church of God, but they've got too many pagan doctrines in there. At least they still have the sign of the Sabbath. But anyway, so the gospel is going to be preached and published. Now, this doesn't tell us the degree or the intensity or how thorough, but we do know that. At the end time, God is going to raise up two witnesses who will be right there in Jerusalem to confront the beast and the false prophet. Just like Moses and Aaron confronted Jannes and Jambres and Pharaoh in Egypt. So it's going to be preached as a witness to all nations, then the end shall come. Now here is what was not fulfilled during the days of the apostles and the assembling of the and canonization of the New Testament. Verse 15. When therefore you shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place. Now, why do we have the next statement in parenthetical statements, which had to be an editorial insertion? Because Jesus did not say in giving this sermon, whoso reads, let him understand. That was inserted later. Why was it inserted? Well, it was inserted because of this. Because when the revolt against the Romans occurred in 66 A.D., from mid-66 A.D. to 70 A.D., 3.5 years. Okay. And also, you have from 63 A.D. to 66 A.D. was not a time of peace. But it was a time of beginning revolt and unrest within the church and within the area of Jerusalem. Now hold your place here and come to 1 Thessalonians, the 5th chapter. Because there is going to come a time of peace. And what is happening in the world today is leading up to that time. Okay? 1 Thessalonians 5. And what is happening in the world today is to lay the groundwork, as we will see, to usher in this time of peace, which will actually be part of the 7 final years, where there will be peace for 3.5 years, and then the events are going to take place, and at the end of the first 3.5 years, then you have the time of tribulation. But here, 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 1. But of the times and seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you, for you yourselves know perfectly. So in other words, they were taught, they were instructed, probably many, many times. So he says perfectly, that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they shall say, peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as travail comes upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. Well, you see, when the apostles and the early church were looking at the prophecies leading up to the time of 70 A.D., they could see that peace and safety was not there. By the time they got to 66 A.D., we had an event occur which is recorded in the book of Josephus, that there was a vision in the temple. And that vision was the glory of God. And it came at midnight. And all of the priests that were on duty saw it. And it lighted up the whole area of the temple and the inner part of the temple. And there was a voice that was heard, let us remove hence. And then that glory, or the Shekinah, was lifted up out of the temple and went and was seen over the Mount of Olives. And over the Mount of Olives, there was, at periodic times at night, there was seen chariots of war over the Mount of Olives. So what happened then was this. There was no abomination that made desolate. Rather, in 66 A.D., the Christians and many of the Jews who were not Christians left Jerusalem. Most of them went to Pella. And there was a huge community of Christians in Pella, which is north about 60 miles and east of Jerusalem. Many of the Jews went from there into Asia Minor, out of Jerusalem, and on over into Babylon. So we find here that what took place in the prophecy given by Jesus in Matthew 24 was not the thing that took place, in fact, before the destruction of Jerusalem. There was no man of sin who went into the temple proclaiming himself that he was God. Rather, what happened was the zealots and a lot of the Christian zealots who stayed there forsook Christ. That's why we have the book of Hebrews written as a warning not to do so, which was written probably about 63 or 4 or maybe 5 A.D. to warn them of what was going to come. So there was no abomination of desolation, no man of sin standing in the holy place in 66 A.D. Now when Jesus gave this, let's read it without that. Come back to Matthew 24 again, please. And let's read verse 15 and leave out that parenthetical statement. And read on the rest of the way through. Okay? Verse 15 again. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, then let them which are in Judea flee into the mountains. Now, they didn't flee into the mountains. They exiled and went to Pella, went to Babylon, went to Asia Minor. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. It wasn't that urgent at that time in 70 A.D., 66 to 70 A.D. when this took place. See, if the abomination of desolation is going to happen to set off the tribulation, then it must have happened in 66 and a half A.D., but that's not what happened. Because let's read on here and we will see that when the abomination of desolation was to take place, then the tribulation was to begin. Verse 18, neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. Woe to them that are with child and to them that give suck in those days. Pray that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day, for then shall be great tribulation. And the then follows the word in verse 15, when you see the abomination, then shall be great tribulation. Well, that did not occur. So when the apostles canonized the New Testament, they had to make a clarification here because they knew through the revelation that God gave to them that it was going to be much more time until the return of Christ. So since that did not happen, they understood that the abomination was going to be for a future time. So you have the parenthetical statement edited in and inserted there. Whoso reads, let him understand. Now, what does all of that have to do with what's going on today? Well, all of that has to do with what is taking place against Islam. And as I gave in the one sermon, against Edom. Now let's go back and review just a few things concerning Edom and Ishmael and Islam. And let's see the source of this because it is for the end time in its final fulfillment. Now we know the promises that God gave to Abraham. Now, let's come back here to Genesis 12, and in some of this, we will just point out the verses. We'll read a few of them, and then we'll summarize it and go to the things concerning Isaac and Ishmael, and then concerning Jacob and Esau. And isn't it interesting that it comes from the same bloodline? But in the case of Ishmael, from a different mother. Okay. Genesis 12. And Genesis 12 is in full force today. Now let's pick it up here in verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abram, get you out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house unto a land that I will show you. Now, I think it's very interesting. A thought just occurred to me here in reading this. We're living in the end time, aren't we? But remember the principle that Jesus gave in the book of Revelation. I am the beginning and I am the ending. I am the first and I am the last. So the way that we understand the end is to understand the first. So isn't it interesting now how many times that in going back and understanding the end times that we come back to the beginning of these things? Because the promises given to Abraham are in full force and effect today. Beginning with the promise that is given here. Verse 2. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you. I will curse him that curses you. And in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And everything that God did for Abraham comes from this promise. Everything. Now, as we look around in the world today, who hates us? Who curses us? We will see it is those who are our illegitimate relatives. So now we have on the world scene a family feud, if you want to put it that way. And even Hillary Billery said, when someone asked her, what's the cause of the Arab problem? She says, it goes back to Ishmael. So if she knows, then a whole lot more people know, but they don't know all the details and how it fits into prophecy. Now let's come to Genesis 15. We've covered that many times, so we will just summarize it. Let's just read a few verses here. Verse 4, God let it be known that he, middle of verse 4 now, Genesis 15, he that comes forth out of your own bowels shall be your heir. Now that's only half of it, because the other half, it had to come out of Sarah. So he brought him forth abroad and said, look now toward the heaven and tell the stars if you are able to number them. So this is a prophecy of the spiritual sons of God, as you can read very clearly in the Christian Passover book. And he said unto them, so shall your seed be. So we have the promise of physical seed, physical son, spiritual seed, spiritual children. The spiritual son was Christ. The physical son was Isaac. And the parallel is brought in there in Galatians, the fourth chapter, between Christ and Isaac. Okay. Now let's come to Genesis 17. Let's pick it up here in verse 1. And when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be perfect. Now that's got to tell you to keep the commandments, right? How can you walk before God and be lawless? How can you walk before God and not keep the commandments? See? And be perfect. What does it say in Matthew 5 and verse 48? Let's hold your place. Let's turn there. Matthew 5 and verse 48. Here we have exactly the same command given to us, right? Notice. Verse 48. Be you therefore perfect. Now we have it stepped up a little bit higher. Even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Now, you talk about a high standard. Do you think God would reject his holy days? God would reject his Sabbath? God would allow sinners? You think that God is lawless? Of course not. So we have the same requirement for us today. So it's no stretch of the imagination that Abraham was under the same spiritual covenant that we are under, and that's why it said in Galatians 3 that if you are Christ, then you're Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Now here's where let's come back to Genesis 17 again. And here is where the family friction begins. Now I won't go through and all the things concerning Ishmael. We'll just come back here to Genesis 17. But let's just take a little detour to Genesis 16 and verse 11. Because you know the mistake that was made. And you know, when Sarah said to Abraham, you know, go into Hagar, my handmaiden. She was not thinking that this was some great sin. Because when a woman was not able to bear children, that's how they got children, through the handmaiden. Now, so she thought it was good advice, but it turned out to be very bad advice because Ishmael was born. And there was great struggle and there was great problem between Ishmael and later Isaac. And, of course, between Sarah and Hagar. Now, I imagine they had their separate tents by that time. You couldn't keep two feuding women under the same roof house, could you? Well, you know the tension that went on. So finally, here we have Hagar. Let's pick it up here, verse 7. She ran off and wasn't going to come back, and then God appeared to her, angel of the Lord, verse 7, found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness and by the fountain in the way to Sur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, where are you coming from and where will you go? And she said, I fled from the face of my mistress Sarai. And the angel said unto her, return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hands. And so she did. And she did for another 13 years. Okay? And the angel of the Lord said to her, I will multiply your seed exceedingly, and that it shall not be numbered for multitude. Now, isn't it interesting that he didn't say, like the stars of heaven, there's no promise of spiritual seed here. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, behold, you're with child. You shall bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. And he shall be a wild man. This is what we have today. And his hand will be against every man. And this is what we have today. And also, I just need to mention here, I think that if anyone converts to Islam, they come under this thing of Ishmael. And I think we can witness that in John Walker, the man who became the Islamic converted man from right over here. What was it? Santa Rosa? From Marin County, right where you folks live. See? You take on the same personality as Ishmael, because the religion of Islam reflects the personality of Ishmael, which we will see a little later, which is, he shall be a wild man, and his hand shall be against every man. And that's what they're worried about in Afghanistan right now. They're saying, okay, the war is going to be over, but what are we going to do about all of these tribal chiefs that are going to be fighting against each other? And if you've seen some of the reports, Afghanistan is loaded with tons and tons and tons, hundreds of tons of ammunition and everything. It's amazing what's going on. And they're hoping that the new government, which is going to be installed, I think, today at noontime our day, or 8 o'clock our time, whichever it was, with Karzai, I think that's his name, who's going to be the interim president. They're wondering how he's going to keep all the factions of the tribal heads from fighting against each other. Well, see, it's in their nature to do that. So it's going to be a very difficult thing to corral all the Arabs. But we will see eventually they're going to do it. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. Meaning, he's going to have to dwell in the presence of Isaac and all of the sons which come from it. Okay, now we have this set up in Genesis 16. Now Genesis 17, let's come here and pick up the rest of the story in verse 2. Comment was made by Al Garcia. He used to drive the bus over there in Marin County for the high school that John Walker attended, and he may have transported him from school to home, and also that's right close to where that mosque is over there in Marin County, isn't it? Now back to the rest of the story, Genesis 17 and verse 2. And I will make my covenant between you, between me and you, and will multiply your seed exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. Now, more than just out of Isaac and Jacob, many nations. And we are going to see that many of the descendants that came from Abraham are still in the area of what we call east of Palestine, and they are also the disinherited, or how shall we say, not subject to the blessing given to Isaac, so they feel disinherited because they didn't get the blessing that was given to Abraham. We'll see that. Neither shall your name be called Abram anymore, but your name shall be Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made you. And I will make you exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come of you. And I will establish my covenant between you and your seed after you and their generations for an everlasting covenant. So there has to be something in this generation which reflects back to this very time of what God said would be happening. And that's more than just to the church, because God is also interested in Israel and the rest of the world and fulfilling all of the prophecies in the Bible leading up to the time of the return of Jesus Christ. But here is the root and source of it. To be a God unto you and your seed after you. And I will give to you and your seed after you the land wherein you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Now, note the land of Canaan. Because when we come to the problem between Isaac and Esau, we will see that Esau came in and lived in the land as if he possessed it and thought that he had taken back the birthright. But he didn't. So let's go on. And I will be their God. And God said to Abram, you shall keep my covenant therefore, and you and your seed after you and their generations, and this is my covenant. So we have the covenant of circumcision that was given. Then we have the blessing given to Sarah. Verse 15. And God said to Abraham, as Sarai your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. For I will bless her and give a son of her also, and yea, I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be of her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born unto him that's 100 years old and Sarah who is 90 years old? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. Now remember, Hagar was an Egyptian. She was of a different bloodline and genetic makeup. And God said, Sarah, your wife, shall bear a son unto you, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his seed. And as for Ishmael, I've heard you. Behold, I will bless him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation, but my covenant will I establish with Isaac. So here's the source of the whole problem with Ishmael. He received a secondary blessing. So he has the dichotomy of living in a desert place with Esau, but he's got all the oil under under the desert. So he's poor, but he's rich. And he still has to lean upon Isaac and Jacob. And Isaac and Jacob have always dominated Ishmael and Esau, and that's where we are today. Now, Isaac is born. Ishmael is sent away. Then we come to the time of Isaac and his wife. Now, there are quite a few things that took place. I'll just summarize it. Ishmael went out and he married those of the Canaanites and the Hittites and so forth. And then he had the 12 princes, so he's a mighty nation too. And I think we're going to be surprised. The number of descendants that came from Abraham, which were not of the promised seed, which came through Ishmael and which came through Esau, which is the whole preponderance of the whole civilization of what is called Islam today, which runs all the way from Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Syria, on into Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and over into the areas where they even converted to Islam, like into Southeast Asia. But they are not the descendants of Esau or Ishmael. Okay, now let's continue on here. Isaac is born. The blessing is given. Hagar is sent forth. And then we have Genesis 22, where we have the finalization of the blessing to Isaac and to his seed, which we have covered many, many, many times. Okay. Now, let's continue on. Let's come here to Genesis 26. No, let's come to Genesis 25 first here. Genesis 25. Here are some of the other sons of Abraham, which also blended in with the sons of Ishmael, and as we will see, Esau a little later. Now, what I want you to do is to understand, read all of chapter 25 of Genesis 25, because it starts out with the other sons of Abraham. Let's begin in verse 1. And then we find that it picks up with the children of the sons of Ishmael right after that. Now, verse 1. Then again Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah, and she bore unto him Zimram, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, and of course Japheth, who is the father of the wife of Moses, was the patriarch of Midian. And Ishbak and Shuha and Jokshan begat Sheba and Dedan and the sons of Dedan and so forth and so on, and all the sons there. Now notice, verse 5. And Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, setting up again the jealousy of inheritance. But unto the sons of the concubines, which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from his son while he yet lived eastward unto the east country. Now at that time he was still sojourning in Canaan, So he sent them eastward. Now, are some of the sons of the concubines, or are those some of the what we call Afghanistans today? I don't know. Could very well be. Let's turn this tape to the other side, please. Now let's continue on here right in Genesis 25. And here, you know, you read all of these genealogical tables and so forth, and when you just read them, you get kind of bored reading them, and you can't pronounce, you know, 80% of the names, and they're weird and strange, and you can't get anything out of it when you read it. But when you understand what's happening, then you can pick up some real important information here. Now, let's read on. Verse 7. And these are the days of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived 175 years. And Abraham gave up the ghost and died in a good old age, an old man, full of years, and was gathered to his people. And his sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave. So they still had peace between each other, at least at that time. And that's one thing funerals always do. They always bring together feuding relatives for a little bit of peace during the funeral. So I guess this is what happened here. Yes, and the field of Ephron of Zoar, the Hittite, which is before Mamre. And this is the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. There Abraham was buried, and Sarah his wife. And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt by the well in Lahai Reel. Now these are the generations of Ishmael. So right after that, you see what we have? We have an accounting for all the sons of Abraham, don't we? Isaac, the sons of Keturah, and so forth. Now, an interesting comment was made during the break that in each case with Isaac, and with, as we'll see a little bit later on, with Jacob, they were both the firstborn of, first with Abraham and Sarah, and then Isaac and Rebekah. You don't count the firstborn from the mother, but from, I mean from the father, but from the mother. So that's why Ishmael could not be counted the firstborn, because it was not from Sarah. He was the firstborn from Hagar. So it was different. Now let's come over here, chapter 25 and verse 19. Now these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, his to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban and Syria. You can go back and read the whole account there. And they had to keep the genetic bloodline without any intermarriage from the Canaanites and Hittites at that time, because this was going to be then leading down to the 12 patriarchs or the sons of Jacob. So that's why Abraham sent off his chief servant to get Rebekah. We find that in chapter 24. Now let's continue on here in chapter 25 and verse 21. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled within her, and she said, "If it be so, why am I this way?" And she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said unto her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two manner of people shall be separated from your bowels. The one people shall be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. That's the source of the problem today. Because the descendants of Isaac there were Esau and Jacob. And Jacob has always ruled over Esau by trickery. That's how it started out. Now, God let it be that way so that it would appear that it was just a fleshly struggle between brothers. But God ordained from the beginning, before the birth, that Esau would not have the inheritance, but that it would go to Jacob. Now, when they were born, let's continue on here. Verse 24, and when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red all over like a hairy garment. I mean, that's rather startling. I mean, you look at that, I mean, you know, I wonder what Rebecca thought when that came out. What is this? See? Very hairy. And they called his name Esau, because that means red. And after that came out his brother, his hand took hold of Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 70 years old when she bare them. And the boys grew. Esau was a cunning hunter and a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. That's why we have of the descendants of Israel today that there are more merchants. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So we've got this family feud going. Now, it was already prophesied before the children were born that Jacob was going to rule over Esau and that Isaac was going to be ahead of Ishmael in the generation previous. So we have all of these things now building. And let's see what happens here. And Jacob sawed pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray you, with that same red pottage, for I am faint. Therefore was his name Edom, which also means red. Now, the firstborn is normally the one who receives the birthright inheritance, correct? That's according to the law of God. But God said before the children were born that the birthright would go to Jacob. But here we have a situation where it looks like the scheming of Jacob got it for himself. So lots of times God works through human events so that it can appear that it's just a human thing rather than God ordained. There the comment was made, but here again we have the favorite of the mother. Okay, let's go on. Let's see what happened. Here's a little collusion. This reminds me a little bit about the mother of the sons of James and John when she came to Christ and said, Lord, would you grant that my two sons, one sit on your right hand and one on your left hand? So we have scheming, politically savvy women within the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? Okay.
So Jacob said, now he's making a deal. Merchandising. Sell me this day your birthright. Rather than Ishmael saying, well, look, I'm going to trust in God and he will give it to me. He said, no. Behold, I am at the point to die. So this is more than just not having a little food and just being a little bit hungry. He was starving unto death. And what shall profit this birthright do to me? Now tie in there the difference between Christ and the temptation with Satan the devil, and how that he, even though under the duress of not eating for 40 days and 40 nights, did not yield to the pulls of the flesh as did Esau. So Jacob said, swear unto me this day, and he swore unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Even though it was foreordained to happen. Now then, we have the blessing given, reaffirmed to Isaac. And then we will see what happened a little bit later. Okay? Now, chapter 26, verse 2. The Lord appeared unto him, that is Isaac, and said, go not down into Egypt, dwell in the land which I shall tell you of. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and will bless you. For unto you and unto your seed will I give all these countries, and I will perform the oath that I swear unto Abraham your father, and I will make your seed to multiply as the stars of heaven. Now notice, even the blessing given to Esau and the blessing given to Ishmael did not contain the blessing as the stars of heaven, or as the sand of the sea. And in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. And then it tells all about what happened here at that time. Let's come over here to chapter 27. Okay? Now we have the chicanery and the sneakiness of Jacob and his mother again. And this is when Isaac was ready to die, and he was to receive the birthright as the blessing. Well, chapter 27, I'll let you read it, but I'll just summarize it. His mother said, look, your father's old and blind and about ready to die. So let's do this. You go in and you get the birthright blessing from him before he dies, because he's got to give the birthright blessing before he dies. And he said, look, I can't do it because I'm a plain man and Esau is very hairy. She said, well, look, I've got it all worked out. I have this goat skin, which is very hairy, and you put it on your head and down the back of your neck, so when he feels it, he will think it's Esau. And I've got it from the outside, so it smells like it's been outdoors, and I will make the venison stew of this goat, and I will make it just like Esau makes the venison stew for his father, which he loves, and you go in unto him and you say, I am Esau, your son, give me the blessing this day. So that's what he did. And let's pick it up here verse 24. And he, that is Isaac, said, are you my son, my very son Esau? And he said, I am. Now you see why Esau was so angry. See. But God determined ahead of time that it would be. So this trickery and chicanery shows how that God even used this to add to the hostility between them. And he said, bring it near, and I will eat of my son's venison, that my soul may bless you. And he brought it near to him, he did eat, and he brought him wine, and he drank. So let's make this really good. We'll give him some wine, let's make it all comfortable and good. And his father Isaac said unto him, Come near unto me and kiss me, my son. He came near and kissed him. Now this is really, I mean, you've got to have a good disguise for this to work, right? And he smelt the smell of his raiment and blessed him and said, See, the smell of my son is as the smell of the field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore the Lord give you the dew of heaven, the fatness of the earth, plenty of corn and wine, and let people serve you and nations bow down to you, and he be Lord over his brethren, let his mother's sons bow down unto you, and cursed be everyone that curses you, and blessed be that everyone that blesses you. Now you can only give it once. You can't give that twice. So it came to pass, as soon as Isaac had made the end of the blessing Jacob was yet scarce gone from him, from the presence of Isaac his father, that Esau his brother came in from hunting. You know, you could make a fantastic movie out of this. I mean, you know, not the chicanery of the stupidity of most religious movies, but I mean, you know. Who also made the savory meat and brought it into his father and said, Let my father arise and eat his son's venison, that my soul, that your soul may bless me. So they knew it was the day of the blessing to receive the birthright inheritance. Both of them knew. And both of them knew that it had to be, that it was going to be overeating the venison stew. So what a deal this was. And Isaac his father said unto him, Who are you? And he said, I am your son, your firstborn, Esau. And Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, Who? Where is he that's taken the venison and brought it unto me? I've eaten of all before me and before you came, and have blessed him. Yea, he shall be blessed. And when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with a great and exceeding bitter cry and said to his father, Bless me even also me, O my father. And he said, Your brother came with subtlety and has taken away your blessing. And he said, Is he not rightly named Jacob, which means supplanter? For he has supplanted me this two times. So we've got family feuding, fighting and fussing on big time scale, which comes even down to our day. And notice, who still rules over Ishmael and Esau to this day? The descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What is the main coalition of the fighting force against the terrorists? United States, Britain, and the democracies of Northwestern Europe, including Australia and New Zealand. So there we have it. He has supplanted me these two times. He's took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. And he said, Have you not yet reserved the blessing for me? And Isaac answered and said unto Esau, Behold, I have made him your Lord, and all his brethren have I given to him, all his brethren have I given to him for servants, and with corn and wine I have sustained him, and what shall I do now unto you, my son? In other words, he can't give it away twice. And Esau said to his father, Have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me, O my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And Esau his father answered and called unto him, Blessed shall your dwelling place be, far as it should read, from the fatness of the earth and from the dew of heaven above. And by your sword shall you live, and you shall serve your brother. And it shall come to pass that when you shall have the dominion, that you shall break his yoke from off your neck. And we can say right here very clearly that the yoke has not been broken off the neck of Esau and Ishmael to this day. Because who is lording it over them to this day? Verse 41. Esau hated Jacob. Now remember. Remember, what did it say going clear back to Genesis 12? Bless those that bless you, curse those that curse you. Now here he hated him. And of course, God hated Esau. Now we covered down on another sermon here just recently. He hated him because the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. Now, if he received the same blessing, why would he hate him? He received the opposite blessing. Far from the choice places of the earth. And the days of the mourning of his father were at hand. And then will I slay my brother, that is afterwards. Well, we'll just make a long story short and we'll just summarize it. Jacob went up to get his wife from over there in Padan Aram. And you know the story. He got Rachel. That's who he was supposed to get, but he got Leah instead because Laban, his father, tricked him. So a little trickery back on the tricker, huh? Trick or treat for both of them. So then he had to labor 14 years for Laban. After he came back, during that 14 years, Esau had gone out, made himself a name. He married many wives, Philistines, Canaanites, Egyptians, and Hittites. And he virtually conquered all of the land of Canaan. And in history, he's known as Hercules. And so when Jacob and Esau finally meet again, Jacob came and he was thinking, you know, Esau's going to kill him. And he sent the whole entourage with presents and so forth. So Esau was very nice because he figured he had compensated for the lack of that blessing of the birthright because he had all conquered all of those lands, so he was gracious to him. And when they met, he didn't kill him. Okay, then the rest of the story, the 12 sons of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, rather. Then those come down to the blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh. Those come down to the blessings of the 12 sons in Genesis 49 and Deuteronomy 33, which talks about the last days. But remember that. Esau and Ishmael have not yet broken the yoke. And we see that in the midst of this battle, now let's bring it up to date, where we are today. Question, how did Ishmael handle this and Esau handle it? Well, we told you how Esau handled it. He thought he had gained the upper hand because he had conquered the land, and here comes his brother back from Padan Aram, and all he's got are flocks of goats and no land and nothing. See? So he thought he had the upper hand. Well, what about Ishmael then? Okay. We're not told about what Ishmael thought about it, but I think the same thing probably happened. Okay. Because the fulfillment of these prophecies come down to the last day. And now we're seeing everything being worked out today. Now, if Israel is going to be a blessing to the world because of Abraham, and Ishmael and Esau had the hatred, then Ishmael and Esau turn out to be a curse to the world. Now, let me read an article. Let's bring us up to date here. An article out of the National Review, December 3rd, 2001, written by Cato Byrne, who's on Crossfire, if you have CNN. Now, she has no axe to grind. But she says, concerning Islam, she says, this year, as in the past, our Muslim world partners in the Coalition Against Terrorism were prominently featured among the most violent and intolerant regimes in the world. Religious minorities are persecuted in over 20 states where Islam is the official religion or dominant religion. Remember it said, Ishmael would live by the sword. Esau, every hand would be against his neighbor and live by the sword. So here we have both of them together. We find here in the Sudan that they've killed over 2 million professing Christians. In the 20 conflicts around the world we have today, we have, because of fundamentalist Islamic religion, and part of what is happening today is to force the Islamic religion to modify its violence against the rest of the world. And who is enforcing it? Joseph and the descendants of Jacob, or Israel. Now, I won't go through the whole account here, but it's quite a long article. But she cites a book here right at the end of the article. In his off-cited book, Clash of Civilizations, The Remaking of the World Order. So in order to come back to the point that I first mentioned in 1 Thessalonians 5:2 concerning peace and safety, there is going to have to be an enforced modification of the Islamic religion to modify its extremist and militant position enough for the one world order to come into place and to have peace and safety. So here's what he writes. Samuel P. Huntington in this book writes, "Wherever one looks along the perimeter of Islam, Muslims have problems living peaceably with their neighbors." And we might say with one another. Muslims make up about one-fifth of the world's population, but in the 1990s, they have been far more involved in intergroup violence than people of any other civilization. Huntington further argues that Islamic militancy is not a heretical strain of Islam. The underlying problem for the West is not Islamic fundamentalism. It is Islam, a different civilization whose people are convinced of the superiority of their culture, but are obsessed with the inferiority of their power, and I might add, unquote here, because the yoke has not been broken. Quite an article. So now, I preached on this last week down south, and this week as I'm going out of the checkout stand, here is Newsweek magazine. Picture of OBL right on the front. And the answer is, after the evil, what can be done to reform the Arab world? That is the question. And it's made more difficult because where do we get our oil? Now, when you consider Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Oman, the Arab Emirates, Iraq, Iran, then you go up to Uzbekistan. They've got oil reserves up there that there's no end to it. Kazakhstan, a little further east, all the sons of Abraham from Keturah and the descendants of Esau and Ishmael. So they sit in these poverty-ridden lands with harsh, extreme dictators over them where they have no freedom. And look what they did to the women in Afghanistan when the Taliban were ruling. They made them live in walking tents. They had to be covered completely from head to toe and look out through this little screen. Can you imagine on a hot day of 120 degrees going to town to shop in that garb? Now, what has happened? They are so happy that the Americans came in and lifted the heavy hand of the Taliban, because you see, the truth is that the overlords of these people in these regimes and their rulers put a heavier yoke upon the people than the yoke that is yoke of Jacob upon these descendants. So now, the descendants of Jacob, being Israel, have to come in and reform these people. Now, what did this article, see if I can get some quotes out of it. And the reason that I brought it and decided to do it again is because I gave the sermon down there last week and then this article comes out. So what happens when the U.S. diplomats go to talk to these, like Mubarak of Egypt? He is a dictator. Hadad of Syria, he's a dictator. Hussein of Iraq, he's a dictator. The king of Saudi Arabia is a dictator. They oppress their people. And the solution is this. They oppress their people, and who do they blame? The sons of Jacob or Israel. That's why they hate us, because they have the bitterness of Esau and Ishmael, which they put down on their people, but they're the ones who are oppressing their people. And then they blame America. So when the diplomats come in and talk to these leaders and say, what are you doing about human rights and oppressing the people? Well, they tell them about the other alternative, which is this. If you don't want us ruling this way, because we're still your friends now, remember, and we're supplying your oil, consider the alternative. The alternative is fundamentalist ruling this country. Now, do you want fundamentalists ruling this country? And then you take all of the other countries, and that's what they say everywhere they go. And you even hear it in the news today when they say, we ought to go in and get rid of Hussein in Iraq. And they say, no, he's got a secular government. If we take him out, it will be the fundamentalist in there who will come and take over. So what they say, the solution is this. We go into all of these countries. You watch. Next, we're going to go into probably Yemen. We'll probably go into Lebanon and get rid of the terrorists. And then we will tell these regimes, this is the solution that they have in here. So I'm just summarizing it for you. Then we will bring more human rights and middle-class business so there is freedom among the people. Because this is what they did in South America during the 80s. They got rid of all of the dictators down there by bringing in human rights, by bringing in freedom. So now they have democracy. A country that hated us in the past, Chile, with a passion. Now we're friends and allies because we help build up the economy and we have free trade. And so this is what they are saying is going to be the solution for these Arab nations. So the war that is going on now, which is going to be protracted and for many, many years to get rid of all of this evil, you see, it is going to lead to a stability and peace temporarily. But what it will never do is remove the hatred for the sons of Israel. So what will happen? Let me just say this. I think we will see this policy succeed and be pretty much of a success. But remember, seething beneath that is the bitterness toward America and Britain and Europe. Now, I believe that when it comes down to the time of the beast power coming into power and the the invasion and destruction of especially the United States and Britain, because those will be the first two to go down. I believe that they are going to use combination. I think it's pretty well correct what Eric Phelps says in his book. Combination of Islam and Chinese to conquer America. That's when the yoke will be broken. Now at that time, when that happens, then the King of the North is going to come down and try and quell it, and it's going to, then we'll get on into the Great Tribulation from there. But anyway, that's where I see where we are in prophecy and how it ties in, how the end time, we have to go back to the beginning to understand where we are. And so we do have more time than we figured, but we are closer to the end than we ever have been, so that tells you exactly how long we have left. Let's just have a little add-on here. The fulfilling of these prophecies is really a complicated thing when you think of it, right? There are a lot of things that have to take place, and it's going to be different than we expected, but it's going to happen exactly like God said. Comment was made that the pride of our power has not been broken yet. All you have to do is just see what we've done with just a few troops over there. I mean, you compare our weapons with what the Afghanis were fighting with, and it's like World War I versus, Star Wars. They have these old broken down tanks and these old bazookas and these old, they still have these bolt action rifles that they use. It's unreal. Comment was made, these people are so warlike and fierce that they're always fighting each other, but they're so intent on fighting each other that they don't know how to develop sophisticated weapons. So we come in and look like we have come from outer space from Star Wars, and they are just in awe. But look at the reaction of the people in Afghanistan, and you will see how this policy works. The women are taking off their tents. They're able to listen to even Afghani music. They wouldn't even let them listen to any music. No TV, no movies, no education for women. And look how they're all blossoming out. I saw one report on television where They built this dish to receive television, so they had enough ingenuity to build a dish, so they could get satellite TV. And someone had a TV, and everyone was over there watching it. And the little kid said, "We have freedom. We have TV." So once they taste the freedom that they're going to be given there in Afghanistan, that's why all the effort to make this take hold in Afghanistan, they are systematically going to go after Yemen, Saudi Arabia, the Sudan, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran. Iran right now is almost halfway converted to it because they've had the fundamentalist religion there and they're worn out and sick to death of it. So they have many more moderates now. And it's going to happen in these other countries. Once they see that, then it'll be brought about. Question is, what makes these people think they're so strong when they're so weak? Look at Saddam Hussein in Iraq. He was boasted as having, the second best army in the world outside of the Soviet Union, or third best outside the Soviet Union in the United States. Oh, we went over there and in 3 days wiped him out, scraped the face of the earth and destroyed everything. Well, why do they think they're so strong? I think it is in their nature, because it's in their nature, every hand against his neighbor. And to being wild people, that when it's the vanity of their own inferiority. Let me read it here. It says, it is Islam, a different civilization. No, the underlying problem for the West is not Islam, fundamentalism, but it is Islam, a different civilization whose people are convinced of the superiority of their culture. God is with us, though we don't have all the power. And Allah, by the way, as I gave on a sermon, is really the god of war, Mercury. And are obsessed with the inferiority of their power.
Now, you watch the interview, that tape that was just released this past week with Saddam bin Laden and the sheikhs in there bragging about how wonderful it was and what a good job they did, you know, and it accomplished more than they ever expected, and they didn't think that the Twin Towers would come down, and they're all sitting there, Allah be praised, Allah be praised, all the way through it. See? They're also under demonic illusion as well. See? So when you start cursing those that God said He would bless, you're in deep trouble. And the thing that makes it even more difficult for them to understand is this, which is another source of the conflict. I do have a little more time on the tape, so we'll finish it here. They are strict in marriage. They are strict, no abortion. They are strict, no homosexuality. And it frustrates them to no end that the blessing of God would come upon these silly people, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob through Joseph, that these men, many of them who do not have enough manliness to grow a beard, and they have this civilization where they allow this freedom which we don't allow, which is against Allah. And they allow homosexuality, they allow divorce, they allow all of these things. So therefore, we have to have the superior civilization, and Allah is with us. So if we go after them, Allah will bless us and we will overcome them. And that's the inferiority of trying to come out from underneath the yoke all through the centuries. I mean, you go back and you look at all of the times coming down with the rise of the Muslims and conquering all the Middle East and all of North Africa and coming up to the very doors of being able to conquer Europe, they are still in that 7th century mentality. And when Islam came in and took Constantinople in the 1400s, they came to the very doors of Europe, came right up to Vienna. And that it hadn't been for the Germans to come down there and stop it, they would have gone in and conquered Europe. Well, they've had the fight with this going through the Crusades and everything all the time. All of history, if you view it. Now, you have to put China over here and Japan over there, but the history between the sons of Jacob and the sons of Abraham, the good and the bad, it's been the fight between the descendants of Isaac and the Ishmael and the descendants of Esau. All the way through. Even the Crusades had to do with that. So here we are at the end of time, and I think that this policy will work. I mean, what are they going to do? Can they raise a hand and fight against us? No, because the brother still has the yoke on them and rules over them. So they will be forced to modify and fulfill the prophecy that there will be peace and security. Well, I'm out of tape. The overseas offices are Canada, Post Office Box 125, Brockville, Ontario, Postal Code K6V5V2. For Australia, Biblical Truth Ministries, GPO Box 1574, Sydney 2001. New Zealand, Post Office Box 242, Waihai 2981. Republic of South Africa, Post Office Box 2624, Wilro, Park, Postal Code 1731. United Kingdom, Post Office Box 8224, Witham,
postal code CM81WZ, United Kingdom.